Hello everyone, and I've got Seb already joining me. Hi, your video is meant to be off, but that's absolutely fine. You stay there because I'm going to introduce and then introduce you. And I'm sure you're going to be blushing when we get to the introduction. But a very warm welcome to you all for the Power of Collaboration. Many of us have been pivoting, reframing, and I think it's very fair to say that now, more than ever, collaboration is key, and that we know that when we come together as a collective, a community, that together we're stronger, and that's something that society we're really passionate about. So today, we're going to be discussing what opportunities there are and initiatives post-COVID and how we can together address the impact it's had on our economy and share some best practice and learnings. So we've got a two-part format for today. First up, we're going to hear from Lord Sebastian Coe, who said we can all call him Seb, which is very cool and makes it slightly easier with the questions for sure. And then we are having three other great leaders join us, Guy, Ellie and Issam, to take part in a conversation. And at that part, that's when you get to ask any questions you like. But please, please, please keep them pithy, especially since we haven't got a huge amount of time. We've got quite a few contributors, and only use the Q&A function for that. I say it every time, and then lots of questions come into the chat function, but that's essentially used for chat. But let's check the chat is working, and let's see where people are dialing in from. So say hello, where you are coming from in terms of where in the world, and how you're feeling today in one word. So let's see how the chat's working. And we've got lots of people joining us, which is really exciting. Hi, Brittany, Cara, brilliant, hopeful, Dubai. I love it. Truly global. That's what's really happened in this interesting and uncertain times, is we've really come together as a global community. And the opportunity to do that and to do that at pace has been really fantastic for the Marketing Society across all of our seven hubs. Dubai, feeling great. Hello from Yorkshire. How are you doing? I bet the weather's slightly nicer in Dubai than it is in London. Oh, hi, Emma. We're speaking soon from London. Nice to see you. Hello from London. Lots of London, West Sussex. Loving it. So we've got people all over. Dubai, Edinburgh, Abu Dhabi. Amazing, amazing. Lots and lots of great people. So the chat function is definitely working. So obviously he's on the screen already, so I'm going to keep this intro as short as possible, because if I read out all his accomplishments, I think it's fair to say we wouldn't have time for the actual webinar in any way. But it's fair to say Seb is one of the UK's most prolific world record setters and arguably the greatest runner to compete for his country. You're going to start blushing now, aren't you, Seb? Over the years.
I'm just worrying about the arguably bit.
The greatest. Brilliant. I love it.
No, I'm joking.
Over the years, as well as a string of world records and gold medals, he has achieved many, many accomplishments. Appointed MBE, even 8 years later, promoted to OBE, receiving a life peer, becoming Lord Coe of Ranmore, and later a KBE. I mean, goodness me. And if you're not feeling worthy enough already, in 2012, he was responsible for the Olympic and Paralympic Games hosted in London, one of our UK's most successful missions of all time. Following the London Games, Seb became chairman of the British Olympic Association and executive chairman of CSM Sport and Entertainment, who we've collaborated with to make today happen. Our friends that we love that all over the world. It's fair to say, with his energy, passion and innovation, he captivates audiences the world over. So without further ado, Seb, it's over to you. Look forward to the chat in a bit.
Gemma, thanks very much indeed, and no pressure there then, guys. I think it was a former teacher of mine that once reminded me that we only ever reach perfection on our CVs, but thank you all the same. And Gemma, thank you also for giving me the opportunity to join your webinar this morning, or this afternoon, wherever you happen to be in the world. And it was great to see so many global attendees. And thank you to the Marketing Society and the work you do across your seven hubs. And we're delighted at CSM to be partnering with you on this. Look, this is a great moment. You don't need me to say that to any of you on this call. This is a great moment for us just to maybe press the pause button for a little bit, think about ourselves as individuals, think about ourselves as organizations, where we want to be in 4 years, 10 years, 20 years time. There's never been a better moment to do that. And the concept of the power of collaboration, which is what it says on the tin, is probably the most piquant element that we're all trying to deal with at the moment. The brands, the companies, the organizations that are trusted, that have a shared values, shared purposes, and suffused by a vision, are the ones that are going to survive this. But collaboration absolutely sits at the heart of that. And I probably don't need to say to any of you, because that's the same in my world, I can't remember a more challenging environment through which we've had to navigate all our organizations. And the imposition, the challenges imposed on us by pandemic have hit pretty much every organization out there. Some have bounced back a little quicker than others, but I think we all understand that collaboration and another adjective I'm going to use in a few moments are probably the key to our longevity and our ability to deal with the challenges that have been thrown at us in large numbers. The other adjective I was going to use is the word resilient, because I've always instinctively understood from pretty much everything I've done, and I'll talk about the two or three key elements of my life, that yes, collaboration, the suffusion of talents and shared values, shared purposes, absolutely essential. But unless the relationships that you are creating to be collaborative with and within are really underpinned by a resilience, then it's probably not going to happen in the way that we would like it to do. I was out running last night, and in advance of the thoughts of pulling stuff together today, it did occur to me that I've sort of had four key chunks in my life. And clearly an athletics career. I was an international athlete for the best part of 14 seasons, an athlete in total for well over 20. I then had a short political career. I was a member of parliament for a few years and then became chief of staff in a major political party in the United Kingdom. Then I got, as Gemma, you kindly reminded me, thrown into the bid for the London 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games. And then, having successfully sort of navigated that with the most extraordinary teams, I then ended up delivering the most complicated piece of project management known to man under normal circumstances, certainly in any city, the Olympic Games. And then throughout all that, there was a business career, which brings me to this table today wearing my CSM hat. And then, of course, in 2015, I became president of the world's the largest Olympic sport, World Athletics, 214 federations across five continents. But I guess without going through the minutiae of detail across the CV, the commonality in all those areas of activity has been, at its best, collaboration, and actually at its worst, the lack of collaboration. So let's park politics for a moment, because actually the one area of my life where I recognized there is probably the least collaborative ethos is actually in politics. And I don't really want to delve into that for too long, but I think we all recognize that often decision-making is inhibited and slowed down by the very tribal nature of it. I understand that probably better than most. And politics tends to operate on slightly less objective analysis that we would have in our own businesses. Preferment, advancement is often a little bit ad hoc and can be, and actually members of parliament often feel that way. And there was a very, very good book written not long ago describing the political landscape as effectively the politicians that we deserve. And it's actually, if you have a few moments, it's worth a read. So let's park politics, because that's not a good example of collaboration or resilient relationships. So the first element of my life was athletics. And I picked out for the purposes of this morning just one moment in my career. And it was in 1978 when I lost the European Championships. Not completely unexpected. I was a newly, freshly minted economics graduate from Loughborough. I was out in the jobs market looking for jobs as well. And I was thrust into the first, my first major outdoor championships, and I got beaten. No great surprise, undercooked, still physically and mentally needing a lot more understanding about my sport. And I always remember that evening sitting down with my coach, and everybody, I tried to do something that nobody had ever done before in a race. I tried to run from gun to tape. It didn't in the end work out hugely successfully, although I did nick a medal. And everybody criticized me. There was a wave of criticism about you dared to done before, you ran out of petrol in finishing straight, you know, mistake 101 athletics, the usual, you know. And actually later that evening I was greeted by my coach, who slung his arm around my shoulder and said, "That was fantastic. Now all we need to do is run the second lap as fast as the first lap." And I went, "Oh, no shit, Sherlock, thank you for that advice." But the reality of it was, what he then did in pulling a team together was to recognize the market had moved on, that we needed to do things very differently. We needed to challenge the orthodoxies, the status quo. And he pulled together a group of specialists that were extraordinary. And they probably quintessentially in my life defined the word collaboration. They were world-class. My coach, who was also a production engineer and doubled up as my father on occasions as well, also recognized that he didn't need to be the world's greatest physiologist or the greatest anatomist, but he did need those people around the table. He choreographed it from the middle. And what I slowly absorbed over that year or so was just the way this group worked together. They woke up in the morning with a shared vision of turning me into the fastest 800 meter runner of my generation. And they did it with discipline and focus and excitement and, yes, collaboration. And the relationships were resilient. They didn't step on each other's toes. They shared credit easily. And when the first wave of criticism came to me about running and doing something entirely different than nobody had ever done before, the second wave of criticism came from the mitigations that we were putting in place and the new sciences that we were absorbing and sharing, and the fact that we were doing things completely differently. Then the second wave of criticism comes, was actually instinctively, and you know exactly what I'm saying, most people don't like, they get nervous when, you know, they get parted from the herd and start plowing their own path. And the real skill in management, I think, is when you undertake that path that's less well trodden, you always are trying to make sure that when going gets difficult, because it always does when you're trying to do new things, that you don't end up heading for home and having teams that become demotivated. And all that is something in your organizations you're probably recognizing at the moment. And to cut a long story short, 1 year later, I not only ran the second lap as fast as I ran the first lap, I broke a world record that effectively stood for 18 years. And I say that not because that is a sort of celebratory note in my own language this morning. It is just to absolutely underpin the nature of the way this group came together and spent all their waking hours and probably most of their sleeping hours as well, figuring out how they could remove every inhibitor from my day that allowed me to do the very best. And that 1 year not only shaped my athletics career, because the obvious point to make here, and I hope you all accept this, is that you learn more often from losing something than you do from winning. I would never have probably had the impetus, my coaches, the teams I worked with, would never have had the incentive to rip up the playbook and start doing things differently if I'd actually triumphed that day. I always look back and actually quietly think, thank God I didn't triumph that day, because the rest of it might not have happened in the way that it was incrementally and sequentially then put together. And if I roll, I'm now carbon dating myself, but if I now roll the video forward 40 years, 42 years actually, I now look back and recognize that actually the mindset that I took out of that year and then out of my career was the mindset that helped me, for instance, put the bidding team together for the London Games. And what did I learn? I learned very simply the art of collaboration in a resilient relationship and in a resilient environment, and recognizing the fundamental that be uncompromising about the people you select to work alongside. Also make sure that you surround yourself with people that are far smarter than you. That's the greatest mitigator against risk in any organization. And if you find the right people, trust them, don't micromanage them, and let them get on with the job. And that is exactly what I did, in essence, through the bid and then the London years. And I pay massive tribute to the skill sets that came to the table, not all from sport. We were very Catholic in the way that we reached out beyond our own sporting beltway to find talents and the best people in the marketplace to help us deliver our broadcast, to help us deliver the project itself, the strategy, the management planning, our transport systems. All that worked. And of course, the project could not have survived 1 week, let alone 7 years, if it wasn't based on a shared vision, but underpinned by the ability to work seamlessly together and also to reach out beyond your own organization and form those resilient relationships that also help you deliver, in our case, the games. And I just scribbled them down. You know, there were 205 National Olympic Committees, 169 National Paralympic Committees, 19 government departments in the UK helped deliver the games. You can't do everything yourself. You can't create intelligence or security structures from within an organizing committee that prevent acts of terrorism at a games. All that has to be farmed out with resilient relationships elsewhere. We had three prime ministers over that journey, two mayors of London, four secretaries of state, and about five sports ministers. And I'm just talking about a narrow sliver of the project. And that project would not have held together. The glue from the middle was the organizing committee, but we also had to recognize that those relationships were absolutely crucial. And let me give you two examples of where they were. When G4S told us they effectively couldn't actually manage the IT systems that allowed us to access all our trained security teams a few weeks out from the games, that would have been an absolute melting pot had we not then had the resilient relationships with the constabularies, the Home Office, our Ministry of Defence, that allowed us to very quickly replicate those numbers by the contingency arrangements we had around 16 other police constabularies and 11,000 troops that were able to then allow us to say, this is not a crisis, it's only a different mix in our security. When we had the global financial crisis, had our resilient relationships and collaboration not been as strong as they were with government, and when the banks and all the construction and development businesses ran for the hills, and all our construction, and particularly the village, was in the private sector, our ability to get the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, at the time, to flick that into the public sector overnight allowed us to go on creating those opportunities, meeting those timelines, and mitigating against the risk. So collaboration is vital, but it actually doesn't count for very much unless you've worked on those resilient relationships in the background. And if you look at the project is extraordinary. You start off with 60 people that are your bidding team, and on the eve of the game, 7 years later, you end up with 8,500 people in an organizing committee, and you get there by doubling your numbers every year. And for those of you who have an HR background, you will know exactly the complication. And when you've parked that complication, you then meld 70,000 of the best volunteers that any games has ever been offered into that mix as well. And I guess that for me was not just the absorption of what was going on in Prague at the European Championships 40 years earlier. It then took me into some of the lessons that we've all had to learn to live with and adapt to very quickly over the pandemic COVID-19. And in my case, I now chair an organization in world sport that has 214 different countries, 5 continents. And our ability to communicate, our ability to collaborate, our ability to be flexible, our ability to disseminate information, and our ability also to start thinking around the strategies that get our athletes back into competition and our competitions back onto the landscape has always to be geared to the latest scientific and medical advice that we also live with. Again, a suffusion of collaboration, but resilient relationships. And the technology that is bringing us together today is the technology that, well, I probably couldn't pronounce most of this technology 6 months ago, 6 weeks ago. And yet, just a few days ago, I joined a call with over 1,000 technical officials in South Asia. And I was able to address them all for a few minutes in advance of a 5-day Congress. So I think the questions we're all going to be asking ourselves as we come out of this is, yes, collaboration, yes, resilience, but actually, how are we going to work smarter? I told my council just the other day, do never expect me to sign off on 8 people flying 8 time zones to deliver a 45-minute presentation to us, to get back onto the, or have supper with us, because we are a courteous lot, and then to fly home. It just makes no sense. We can't remove human interactivity, but I do think this is the moment for us to figure out that there are some big issues beyond pandemic, global security, our ability to adjust ourselves as humans to the local conditions, and how do we as organizations come out of this stronger, more resilient, certainly more collaborative, and actually more reflecting the world that we live in, and particularly young people who are now looking for a lead because they sit at all the big moral hotspots. And we've only had to witness the appalling scenes, sadly, that we've witnessed just in the last few days, both in the US and actually reflected in other parts of the world, to know that we do live in complicated and troubling times, and maybe the pandemic has given us the opportunity just to recalibrate our lives and those people in our organizations by helping them to be better people in a more accomplished, re-engineered organization this time next year than we are now. So I hope that sort of, Gemma, sets the scene a little bit for today. And I'm really happy to hand back to you. I've tried to keep it within the confines of 10 minutes, and I hope I've thrown out a few disparate enough thoughts to stimulate what I know will be a great discussion. And I'm delighted to be joined by such other high caliber contributors today. I'm very flattered, and thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you. I want to give you applause that I'm sure everyone else is right now. You probably were getting a standing ovation. That was brilliant. You didn't stick quite to time, but who cares? You know, it was absolutely...
Tell me it wasn't an hour.
You were fine. It was perfect. And I just feel like, and I'm sure the audience will agree with me, we've just been treated to a bit of a masterclass. So thank you so much. And I'm really looking forward to the rest of the conversation. I want to summarize some of the key takeouts from yours. But actually, in the interest of time, I'm going to bring on everyone else so us we can keep on having this conversation and bring everyone else in. So without further ado, come and join me. First up, we've got Guy. He's going to introduce himself. Share how he's feeling. Hi, Guy. And you're not on mute. That's great.
No, I'm not talking to myself, as we all do on mute. No, I'm Guy Kinnings. I work at the European Tour. I am the Deputy CEO, Chief Commercial Officer, and the Ryder Cup Director. And I'm absolutely delighted to be on this, because it means I've managed to step out of what was an incredibly tricky financial planning meeting to be with all of you. So thank you.
Brilliant, brilliant. Welcome, Guy. Come and join us, Ellie.
Hi, I'm Ellie Norman, joining you from home in West Sussex, and I work at Formula One, and I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications. And my one word, Gems, would be hopeful as well.
Like that. Very nice, very nice. And last but certainly not least is Sam. Come and join us.
Hi, everyone. I'm joining you guys from Dubai. So I'm Assam Calvin, CEO of the Dubai Corporation for Tourism and Commerce Marketing, which is effectively the marketing and the sales arm for the destination of Dubai. And the one word that I would like to say that I'm feeling right now, and maybe Dubai is as well, is optimistic.
Very nice. And we had a lot of optimistic people in our audience as well. So just to recap, any questions now, please use the Q&A function. We've got limited time, but we will try and come to you. But we're going to start getting going with the conversation. So I'm going to start with you, Guy. I was actually going to ask you around challenges. However, hearing from Seb and what he talked about in terms of collaboration, and particularly the resilience underpinning collaboration, I thought I would come to you in terms of what examples have you seen at European Tour of rights holders, teams and brands working collaboratively together for the greater good?
I guess what's interesting is that the challenge has been driven around by what have been our, perhaps in the past, our greatest asset. And by nature, we as a tour are very, very inclusive. We're very diverse. We play 30 countries. We've got 50 nationals playing on the tour. And we interact very closely. We work closely with the women's tour. We do mixed events. And the golf organization is not of the clarity that Seb has described. In golf, you would never have written it this way. There are multiple tours. There are majors. There are different federations and organizations. And it looks a crazy system. That has been a challenge, but what has been good is because of the nature of the relationships we have with all of those governing bodies, we very early sat down with them, addressed the initial challenges, worked through to try and create a global schedule that was sensitive to the health issues, but also found a way of returning the sport as soon as possible so that people, which appeared to be what people wanted, whether that be in exhibitions before we stage our first professional golf tournament on the PGA Tour starts this Thursday. We at the European Tour return in July and run through. And that's required collaboration with all of the tours, all of those stakeholders. We have maybe 1,000 commercial partners in our ecosystem, partners of the tour, partners of tournaments, of players. We pulled together with all of those, pulled with the brands and all the governments, to be able to do what we're doing when we restart in the UK with 6 brand new tournaments, which we've never done before, has required huge efforts with DCMS. But as I said, we replicate every conversation in 30 different countries. So it's required a lot of that collaboration.
And do you agree with the point about resilience that, you know, it's when the resilience is underpinned that you have true collaboration?
Yeah, I think there has to be. There has to be some issue of having to deal with these things. And we all say this is a once in a lifetime experience. And I then got told off by my Ryder Cup captain, Padraig Harrington, who said, don't be ridiculous. We had to consider the postponement, and in fact did, of another Ryder Cup back 20 years ago, following 9/11. And it's dealing with these challenges and learning from them. And as you say, you've got to be resilient and in a sense, almost enjoy the challenges of trying to pull it together. And I think that's been the collective spirit we've seen, not just in our little sport, but with so many of the other sports and everyone we've been dealing with. And I think it's been an acceptance that sport as a whole needs to be resilient. People need it back.
Yeah, no, I agree. What about you, Assam? What's the importance of the events and entertainment sectors for the Dubai tourism industry? I'm sure, obviously, you've experienced many challenges. So maybe start with those. But what opportunities you see that are there for collaboration?
I think from our perspective, I mean, if you look at it from a tourism perspective as a whole, challenges have always been there. I mean, if you look at the geographical location of where we lie within the global map, you'll know that whenever something happens in the wider region, we need to ride those waves and make sure that people continue to come to Dubai as a city and as a destination. I mean, when we launched our own strategy in late 2013, we wanted, obviously, the aim to be the number one most visited city in the world. We were number 7 at that point in time, and we've managed to go very quickly to number 4, and we've maintained that while still growing through challenging times. I mean, even in 2019, we saw roughly about a 5% growth. We received close to 16.7 million tourists in 2019. And obviously, it's a number that was record-breaking for us. And again, the first 2 months of 2020, we saw another 4% growth. We had a very strong start before we you know, are in the situation that we find ourselves in at this stage. And of course, for us, events, whether it's sports or it's music, has always been one of the key propositions or the key pillars of Dubai. If you look at golf, as Guy was just mentioning, we have the Desert Classic, the Omega Desert Classic, that's been running for several years. We have the Race to Dubai, that's been also one of the key events that we talk about and we are proud of here in Dubai. Same thing with the tennis, the ATP and the Dubai Duty Free Tennis that happens over here. And many others, including the Rugby Sevens, Emirates Airlines Rugby Sevens. So it is something that the whole world is attracted to. The whole world is excited to visit Dubai for. Again, for us, we use that as a key aspect of attraction to Dubai. We have about 200 different nationalities that have chosen Dubai to be home. And those people play a huge role in getting their friends and their relatives to visit Dubai. And they use our calendar of events, which actually Dubai Calendar as a brand exists within the bigger Dubai Tourism family. And they form a part of another entity within Dubai Tourism called the Dubai Festival and Retail Establishment. And that establishment's role is to create events events that attracts tourists to the destination. And of course, looking after entertaining the resident community and the UAE community as well. So obviously, needless to say, it is a very important role for us. And Dubai's success has been built on a private-public sector collaboration and partnership. And that will continue to be a very, very important player for Dubai's success in the future.
Thank you. And what a big job you have, my goodness. Ellie, I'm going to come to you now. How have you found the lockdown and the restrictions that we've had have given you an opportunity for trying something new at Formula One?
The positives of lockdown is no jet lag. So it's fantastic to have been in the same country and the same place since the 20th of March, since I returned from Australia. So that's certainly a positive. I think some of the opportunities that lockdown has provided, and actually I think if you look back in history, there is always magic and opportunity that comes from a crisis. It's how you choose to solve that puzzle. And I think one specific example for us in Formula One, clearly it is a fast moving and fast paced sport, and it's fiercely competitive on track. But the sort of lockdown and the stopping of racing on track provided us with an opportunity to collaborate in actually the fight and the race to save lives. And we termed it Project Pit Lane, but it was a number of the Formula One teams coming together and answering the call of the UK government with a consortium to respond to the shortage of breathing aids and ventilators. And for many people, they'll be thinking, well, how has Formula One got any relevance in medical sort of supplies? But in motorsports, there's about 25,000 highly skilled engineers are employed, and many of those are within sort of Formula One. And so the speed at which they were able to look at analysis, the design engineering, manufacturing, chemical sort of fluid analysis, meant that they were able to actually reverse engineer a breathing aid in 100 hours, and to design and work out how to manufacture a ventilator in 2 weeks. And then they actually changed their manufacturing facilities from making Formula One race cars into breathing aids and ventilators. And I think to date, we've delivered 20,000 units to the sort of NHS. So that for me is a incredibly sort of proud element for the sport to really kind of showcase the sort of innovation and the design and engineering that comes from the industry. And I think we're all sort of so fortunate with the merging of the virtual and the physical world. And so esports and our virtual Grand Prix have continued, I think, to fill the gap and provide the escapism and the entertainment that we know sort of real life sports does, and just move that into a virtual space while we've had no live racing on track.
Love that. Absolutely love that. Seb, you mentioned working across, no mean feat, 214 different regions stroke the world, we can only imagine that's been incredibly complex, you know, across culture. So how have you navigated that, and any learnings that you could share?
Well, let me give you a really good example of that from just this morning. Before this call, I was on a call introducing my director of health and sciences, Dr. Stéphane Bermond, one of the authorities. The issue was really simple. I had 150 federations, well over half the member federations on board, and that we were able to communicate some of the challenges around getting the athletes back into competition, how we then have the social distancing needed for our stadiums when we do start getting the events up and running in from, we hope, the middle of August. The one thing that we've learned, actually, it's been a very, very good lesson, that we tend as organizations to come together on high days and holidays. We always try our best, don't we, to communicate and be as collaborative as we can. But actually the reality of it is that I think we've absorbed in the lockdown the ability, for instance, for me to communicate to my executive board once a week, the ability to speak to my five area presidents who represent the global sport once a week, to reach out to the athletes and understand exactly what their fears are and their concerns are, to be able to put Stéphane Bermond in front of over half our member federations this morning and giving them an update on what we're doing in headquarters and how we can help them create those opportunities and safe spaces. So I think that, look, we're not alone in this. I can't imagine there's another single organization from Guy or Ellie or Issam who haven't sort of spent at least a little bit of time figuring out how can we continue to do this in the way that we've been doing it now. Now, clearly, we all have a little bit more time because we're not traveling. The real challenge is how do you continue that level of communication when we're all in airline terminals and, you know, in our own, you know, decision-fueled environment, which at the moment is, it's, you know, at the beginning of all this, I think, I felt that we were talking about months, and I'm guessing Guy and Ellie would agree with me on that. You know, it was something that seemed to be sort of coming down the line, but it was really a Chinese problem. Then we stopped talking in months, and suddenly we were talking in weeks. And then we were suddenly talking not in weeks, but days. Days became hours, and hours almost, it seemed that we were having to make decisions on sometimes questionable information, but we were having to make those decisions all the same over the space of minutes. So I think within all that, how do we continue to make sure that we communicate and we engage in exactly the way we have, because we've had the ability to do that, but how we've probably all set levels of expectations in our organizations that it's going to be hard to maintain.
Yeah, so that's a challenge. It's so true. And just look at this event now. You're in Monaco. Ellie's in West Sussex. Guy's in, are you in Wandsworth? And then we've got, I'm in Twickenham. And then we've got Assam in Dubai. So just, we wouldn't have been able to do that before. So it just shows already the opportunities. I'm right with saying, was it Wandsworth you said you were in, Guy?
Yes, indeed.
Just checking. Unlike any time before, rights holders have had to align and work much closer with government bodies, and we've already touched on that a little bit. What have you learned? And Guy, working across 30 different regions, particularly, I'm going to come to you first.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and Seb described it well, I mean, we were learning on the hoof, and, you know, we are essentially sports bodies that normally rule on, in our case, how you manage the members, our players, how we run the events and pull it all together. And suddenly we were having to deal with rather more important life-changing decisions. And suddenly, if the single one mantra in everything we do is, let's do this if it's safe for the fans, if it's safe for the participants, if it's safe for the people working on the tournament, it changes your mindset. And I think, therefore, the need to work with the governing bodies. So as Seth described it, you know, we've gone from being where the person who was our chief medical officer was someone that we would occasionally call in on a drug testing issue. He's now in every single meeting, and he starts every single meeting, and he leads with all of the conversations we have with every government body, with every tournament, and all of those. So in a sense, I think we've learned to do, we've been lucky. We rely on government support wherever we go to play tournaments. We have commercial sponsorship, and we have the support. And Issam's described it perfectly. We would never been able to do what we've done in Dubai without the vision and the support there from that. And describing the events that have grown there takes that governmental support. So you've already got good relationships. All they need to do is to walk down the corridor and knock on the door of the person who handles the medical side. And you can then have those conversations very quickly. Of course, what's always wonderfully helpful is that in those 30 different countries, they always have just slightly different approaches. Now, some of them are justifiable because the time frames are different and people are coming out of the crisis as others are going in, and you have to deal with it. But even when you realize in the UK, and as we plan events around the UK, there's a difference between what's going on in Scotland and Wales and what's going in England, Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland. And that means you have to work so closely with all of those bodies on a day-by-day basis, because you never know what's coming. Everything changes by the minute. So I think it's a sense, and Ellie will be the same, that you know, F1 do it brilliantly. You've got to engage and be culturally sensitive wherever you go. That allows you then adapt to this current crisis and hopefully be ready to deal with the particular new challenges we face.
Thank you, Guy. And I can see Ellie nodding a lot there. So obviously you've sort of crossed 22 different nations. So tell us your experience, Ellie.
I would certainly concur with sort of both Guy and Seb on the need for just very straight up, honest conversations. And having the right balance of being pragmatic but also optimistic. And I think, you know, certainly one of the things that we've discussed with our government partners across those sort of 22 countries is the virus isn't going away until there's a cure. And so that is hanging over us as a society and across the globe. But I think with the expertise, it's actually how do you mitigate those risks whilst also balancing out that for many of these countries, lockdown is starting to ease, they're opening up economies, and actually the power of live sports and events can do so much to really spotlight a country and actually use that as a way to really kind of showcase elements of what they've implemented to get their sort of countries and their economies going again. And for many of the sort of countries where all of our sports compete, connected to that is a sort of huge tourism business. And so you can't sort of look at one without the other. Everything is kind of interlinked, but it's really sort of, I think, facing into it with agility and flexibility and making sure that you have plan A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and every eventuality. Because I think, as Seb said, that decision-making is very much minute by minute. Often with sort of 49% of your data saying one thing and 51% of the data saying something else. And you need to just be able to be decisive and I think provide clarity and that flexibility to your people as you sort of navigate through this together.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And Issam, how, and I will come to you because I can see lots of questions coming. So just after this one, I will come to you. Issam, how can Dubai tourism and key stakeholders work together, do you think, to alleviate some of the economic impact on the events during this time?
I think, again, all the points that were raised over there are we're very familiar with, and it's something that we deal with on a regular basis. With us specifically, with Dubai Tourism, we've been working very closely with the partners across the board. And this includes whether it's from the private or the public sector. Because for us, we know that in order for any event to be successful, it's one thing about relying on the let's say, the local community. But we also work very closely and collaboratively to bring in a lot of international visitors to come in and attend these events and enjoy these events as well. Because for us, it feeds my purpose of making sure that we're getting the numbers and contribution into the economy. But on the other side, you have the event organizers who can benefit from the experiences that we have in attracting these visitors. So as a prime example, the relationships that we have built with our campaigns, our marketing campaigns, and our reach go well beyond 50, 60 countries on any given time. And to be able to create packages and offers that bundles in, let's say, a Formula One ticket or a golf event related ticket for people to come, stay in Dubai, enjoy the experience that they're having and go back. Those kind of partnerships and synergies are very important for us to find. And once we have established that, then we work with the local partners in many cases who also would want their brand to be associated or their experience to be associated with these relationships as well. And again, for us, because it's been a business as usual model, and that's something that we're very, very proud of, Dubai has always approached any opportunity as a business would. We think more corporate, less government. That's why we can make meetings and things happen instantly. In the current circumstances, we've really joined arms and really shown that solidarity with the world and that we're in this together. We're facing this as you are. And even the messages that went out were aligned with that. But then we quickly moved on to a campaign to talk about the Till We Meet Again, building up the aspiration of, you know what, when things do open up, look at all the safety measures that Dubai has in place. Dubai is clean. It's focused on its health and security of its visitors and its residents just as much as before the COVID and during the COVID. So they feel welcome in Dubai and ready to come to Dubai as soon as markets open up. And this gives our partners and the event organizers a chance to immediately leverage that and hopefully attract people to come in and attend these kind of events as well.
Thank you. Thank you. I love that. So I'm going to go to the questions. And a question is there from my boss, who's also the chairman of the Marketing Society. So have to come to him first. And also, it's a very good question. Great collaboration requires a meeting of minds and an openness to see a different point of view. Have you seen a change in mindset since the onset of the pandemic that has made collaboration easier? And I know, Seb, you started talking about mindset earlier. So I think I'll come to you first, if that's okay, because you said it can come to all panelists. And that's from Craig Ingalls.
Yes, I think I have. I mean, I think we've all recognized probably more flexibility in ourselves as well. You know, when you're trying to figure out some of the challenges, you know, Guy and Ellie summed it up absolutely perfectly well. It's, you know, our science, health and science guy, you know, yes, really important anti-doping processes, you know, welfare of the athletes, but every few hours, the guy is now, you know, giving us his views about, you know, what is happening out there. And that's been hugely important to us. But I also think that I've sensed in organizations that I work in at the moment, just a greater readiness to be flexible. In, you know, under normal circumstances, we all go back to the default position of, well, no, we can't do that because A, we've never done it before, or that's not really sort of what we do. I just think people are now recognizing that, you know, you just do have that. You do need that flexibility. You do need to be able to talk openly. And I think the other thing too is I've also sensed within the organization, and I've said to people within my own organizations, look, you know, it is okay to be fearful. It is okay to be frightened about this. You know, we're not, I think Mark Twain summed it up, you know, fear is not, you know, is not, you know, you can't escape it. It's the master, it's the management of it, but it's okay. I mean, it comes with it. And the challenge for all our organizations is, you know, everybody is going to want to, because we work with passionate people in all our organizations, the risk is it's a bit like the injured athlete that wants to make up the lost ground that they've had sitting on the sidelines for 12 weeks. They want to do it all in 1 week. And I think we as business leaders are going to have to really help them understand and navigate those changes. Some are coming out of lockdown from sitting at the end of their beds, you know, with a laptop all day. Others are in a slightly more fortunate position. And, you know, they may have a garden. But the challenge we've really got is for some coming back into our organizations, it's going to be liberating. For some, it's going to be traumatic. And I think we just have to understand that it's not just about flexibility, that the human condition is also in large part going to take over here.
Yeah, I love that. Guys, is there anything you would add in terms of mindset? But also, there's another question coming in here. around, you know, we know, and Seb talked a lot about, you know, to build a high performance team, you know, to succeed and deliver. The question from Simon is, how do you go about building this team? So as a leader, how would you, and I suppose it starts with what we just talked about, mindset, but what else do you think are the ingredients?
Yeah, I think building a team, in a sense, you work out what your product is, and you then make sure that you've got the people to help deliver it. And clearly, as is very well recognized by all of the other experts speaking here, you know, that product requires so many different elements that you pull in people from so many different angles. And, you know, when you are a little golf tour, you think the most important thing is the people who are going to be out there delivering the product and staging it. And guess what? They haven't had anything to stage for a few months. So what you then do is you turn to other people within the team and you emphasize what they're going to do. So we've had some fantastically young and creative people working on the content side, working on sort of online stuff to keep engaged with the fans. So they've created, and I've loved the stuff Ellie's done with the F1. It's even attracted some of my golfers like Ian Poulter to come and do it. But we've done an indoor tournament. We are going to, when we come back at the tournaments, we're going to make sure the players are mic'd up. We're going to make sure that things are done differently. And as Seb put it, people are fearful, but that does create an opportunity to do things completely differently. And having the right team who'll take advantage of that, including within that team, our own members, the players, they are ready to be flexible. They know they can do something that can help. They will do things differently, engage with sponsors, engage with the fans. Even if there are fewer fans, you can allow them to do things that they wouldn't get to do otherwise. In golf, we're kind of lucky. You know, what has always been the trouble of, you know, covering a sport that goes on a pitch that's the size of 200 football pitches now becomes a benefit. And actually, you know, you can do stuff that you wouldn't have been able to do before because social distancing is easy. So in a sense, it's having that team and getting them to do things that are just slightly different that fit with the new challenges we face.
I think that's really valid, what Guy says. And I think what's been, certainly I think what's very, very interesting now is through this pandemic, I think some of the sort of overt characteristics that have come through is kindness, generosity and community. And actually, I think, you know, in some respects, we're also lucky. In the most case, I'm not an essential worker, so I just can do my work from home. But I've had a newfound appreciation and new heroes in my life. And I think that's most really resonated and is true for all of that. And I think actually that appreciation, we are all able to take back into our own organization. So when we come to collaborating, it is much more from a community perspective. How does this work across sports leagues? How can we help each other out? How can we share best practices and learning? Because we've seen that happen across the front lines in this fight against the sort of pandemic. And I think that's been incredibly powerful. And I think the second thing I would add is with collaboration being the new leadership, when I think about building my team, it's actually not about who is the best person for that job. It's who is the best person for the team. Because I will be great at like one thing and not great and a whole host of other stuff, but it's building a team around you that you carry each other. And so as soon as you have a shared vision, it's then about how do you carry each other forward to deliver on that vision, but to think about it from a team perspective versus an individual job role or spec, I think would be something I'd add to that as well.
Lovely. I mean, what you just said there about it's not about your what you're great at individually. I mean, we always talk about playing to your strengths. So I just want to understand what you mean there in terms of what you just said about collaborating as a team. Because I agree with you, it's about coming together, but playing to your strengths and surrounding yourself with others that complement you.
And it is that sort of complementary bit of knowing what you are strong at and playing to that, but knowing where your blind spots are and not what you're strong at. And that's where you need that sort of collaboration. So you build the best performing strong team versus just thinking about the sort of individual roles, because you need to each have a different set of sort of strengths and characteristics that are going to move you forward. And that's where I think the importance of diversity of thought experiences is so helpful, because we're all We're all so fortunate in how the globe is connected via digital and where our sort of leagues and our sports operate, that we are multicultural, we are visiting other cultures, and at best we provide a window into those cultures, but we need to be listening and understanding and actually using our platforms to further amplify those kind of local cultures and what makes each country and person special.
Lovely. Thank you. And I'm running out of time. So with all the questions, we're going to see if we can get further insights from some of our speakers on them and write a piece, because there are just so many and we've only got a few minutes left. And I want to come to all of you for one final piece. So as we always do in our sessions, it'd be great to hear from all of you a final piece of advice or takeaway that you could give us now on the power of collaboration. So Issam, I'm going to come to you first.
Okay, what I would like to say is basically echoing what my fellow colleagues have also shared. I think the one advice that I would leave behind is, during these times, I think it's become very important that we approach everything, like setting egos aside, right? I mean, the time of us thinking that, you know what, who needs us, come to us and explain to us why I should be involved in this. I think we should approach things with a lot more of an open-minded approach. We know that people now have a much bigger appetite to listen, to really understand how they could work and collaborate. That appetite exists, and I truly believe that. And also understanding that we need to break the status quo, right? And we need to accept the fact that there's a big chance, and I truly believe that we will not go back to how things were, but there will be a new norm to how things would look going forward. And I always think that if you look at it from an optimistic perspective, it just opens up a much, much bigger world. And it's about us accepting things like, before emails were there, we were connected to work within the confines of the office space, at fax or something that comes in, or a call that comes in. And the minute you go home, you're home. Nowadays, we're connected 24/7. Same thing happened with mobile phones. Same thing happened with being able to answer calls and respond to emails while you're on flight. And even social media, the way you engage with the athletes or your the people that you look up to has changed the game as well. If you look at broadcasting, if you look at TV, what the Michael Jordan documentary did now, people who probably weren't following NBA are now interested. Same thing with the series of F1. A lot of people now know the insights, the stories of all of these race car drivers, and it goes well beyond just that one brand that they follow. So that is changing the game and changing how we approach this as well. And I really think it's an opportunity for everyone in this game and in this space to really collaborate, look at things differently, approach things with a new opportunity, and that appetite almost of a startup, to really bring back that startup hunger and appetite and approach this game with that new light.
Love that. Thank you very much, Issam. We're running out of time. So if I can keep the next three responses a tiny bit more soundbitey, that would be absolutely amazing. So I'm going to come to you next, Guy.
I will be very brief. I think the advice would be tear up all your current preconceptions and work practices. Do stuff differently. We know we can work efficiently, travel differently, and learn from it. We've learned from things before, learned from this. These are things we have to deal with. So I would just say, take that sort of skill. And as Seb said it so beautifully at the start, as you pull people in, you know, surround yourself with people that you think are better than you are, which in my case is very easy. But you can then have a lot of people who can, you know, deal with this, and different mindsets, different ages can deal with these things in a very different way.
Lovely. Love that. Ellie. What's your piece of advice?
I think my piece of advice would be empathy, collaboration, absolutely essential sort of moving forward. And I think the three things that people are truly crying out for now would be certainty, clarity, and hope. Certainty we can't really guarantee, but we can certainly provide clarity and hope to the people that we lead. And I think that will allow us to be agile, flexible, and to get to great results.
I love that. And you started with your word as hopeful, and you finished with your word as
always hopeful, Gem.
Love it, Ellie. And last but certainly not least, Seb, give us your pearls of wisdom.
I'm I'm not going to articulate anything better than I've heard in the three lead-ups to this, to the broader point about collaboration, resilience, and I like the introduction of the word empathy as well. I think that's really important. I would just add vision. Look, you know, if we are working in collaboratively and we need resilient relationships, we also need an all-encompassing vision. And maybe sometimes we confuse vision and mission. And vision is probably the most protective thing you can have during your journey through crisis management. It's what you deliver to on a minute-by-minute basis, or it should be. So I think probably there's good time spent just revisiting what the vision of your organization is. And I think once you've really settled on that, I mean, the vision may be perfect. But it may need some refinement off the back of where we've been. But once you've settled on that, it's your North Star, and all the great organizations around this table live by that. And my word is bullish, by the way.
Brilliant. And on that note, time is truly up. So thank you for all of your pearls of wisdom, your insight, your wisdom. That was truly a unique experience. And we're seeing that lots and lots of people are saying that it's really leaving them feeling positive and inspired and hopeful for the future.